Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Giles Brown.
GB. Not GQ.
We are joined by Mike Cormack, our author of Everything Under the Sun, The Complete Guide to Pink Floyd. Mike, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very happy to be speaking to be honest with you, mate. it's the Friday afternoon feeling. Pink Floyd. I don't think there's a band that has undergone a transformation in quite such a subtle way and reflected the times in which they live.
They absolutely reflected the times, you know, from the 1967 psychedelic period, the early 70s period, where it wasn't the 60s anymore. People were starting to ask questions about where everything was going. The late 70s, a great period of strife and bitterness. Then 80s, it was starting to get all a bit psychedelic again. And then the 90s, it was starting to get a bit more. It was the time of, it was after the yuppie, and we were all being a bit nicer to each other. So, yeah, they totally ride that wave and said a lot of things about who we are.
So what was your spark that came, that suddenly struck you and thought, right, I'm going to write the book Everything Under the Sun? Did you think that this was, because it is a really deep dive, isn't it?
Yeah. What set me off was, I guess it was trying to write a book like Revolution in the Head, which is about the Beatles, which does much the same thing. Analyzes every song, gives you a cultural guide throughout their time. Mine also has a bootleg guide, so I give a quick overview of the best bootleg available for every concert that Pink Floyd have done. So I found about 600 out of 1,200 possible gigs to analyse, so that took a long, long time to do.
Good grief, man. Did you just lock yourself in a basement for like the best part of, I don't know, what, 18 months or something for that? I mean, that's the bootlegs, are a legend in themselves, a legion in themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, my day job is a teacher, so that was my summer holidays all gone doing that.
So we kick off, don't we? Because they form in 65. And if you think what's going on in 65, you've got all sort of the Yardbirds and obviously the Beatles are just starting to show that sort of Rubber Soul period going into Revolver. Really interesting. Yeah. Stones are doing their stuff as well. So Floyd, what's Floyd's genesis?
Well, I mean, they started as an R&B band as well. You know, if you listen to the very, very early songs that they did, they were doing R&B covers as well. What's amazing is how quickly they find their voice, and especially the writing of Syd Barrett, and how singular that is. It's so psychedelic. It's about the childhood experience. It's so unique, and it was so well recorded as well. I mean, great props to the band for doing that, and for their Abbey Road engineers for creating the sound world that was totally unique. I don't think it's ever been captured anything like that since.
Do you think that they were kind of because at that time everybody's getting, you know, Sergeant Pepper, then we've got, you know, Beggar's Banquet and The Who and all that sort of stuff, and everybody's doing the hippie stroke movement. Well, would you say the Pink Floyd were sort of counterculture but an acquired taste? You were on trend if you knew who they were, because they weren't shifting massive amounts of albums, were they, at that point, or were they?
Their second single, See Emily Play, went to number 4. Mm. So they were like the darlings of the moment. They played at the Alexandria Palace for the games for May. But after that, you know, I mean, they presented themselves as being art with a capital A.
Right.
You know, we are not just a teenage music, we are art, you know. So once they kind of got into their stride and like after Syd Barrett, you know, they were like saying, well, what we do isn't for everyone. It's, you know, we are different. We are artistic. We are trying to say something. You know, we are taking music and we are progressing it.
If you look at what happens with Barrett and, you know, picture, and the famous pictures of him with, what was the name of the Eskimo? He was dating, he was with a, was it a native, we can't call it that now, an Inuit person. He, you know, his psychedelic adventure leads, you know, to a complete breakdown. So is that sort of the end of the, of that sort of whole psychedelic dream and marks a period of introspection for Pink Floyd?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can see in their music after he left, they're really searching for their path. They don't quite know what they're doing. And to some extent, they're kind of throwing everything up against the wall and seeing what sticks. You know, so it's really fascinating, you know, because they're trying everything. They're going from blues, they do chamber pop, they do proto-techno, they do... folk music, like Birds ripoffs. No, they're really just trying everything. And some of it's wonderful, but some of it is like, what was that? Oh, well, it was a worthy attempt.
And then, of course, we get that album, don't we? Of course, and you can't. It's the 800 light reflecting prism in the corner of the room. And you know, I'm of a generation, and I'm in my late 50s, so I remember my parents buying Hi-Fi. Ask your parents. Of course, yeah. And of course, the album that they used to demonstrate the power of the Wi-Fi was invariably, not my parents, but the people who were selling the Hi-Fi, would be Dark Side of the Moon, because it was the whole thing with clocks and bits of voices and things going from speaker to speaker. And it had a huge effect, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is where the Floyd go from underground to massive success. They never even, I don't think they've had an album go even gold before. Suddenly they're multi-platinum. And they recorded Dark Side over quite a long period. It took them well over a year to record it, and they were touring it at the same time. So everything was really refined. Everything was really honed and worked on. And the engineering on it is absolutely stellar, of course. I mean, that's been... everyone knows like how well it sounds still today.
I mean, 70, I mean, it is a sort of, can you argue that that album and then the ones that sort of follow it, all, you know, huge hits, are you know, and deservedly so, are a reflection of what it's like to be a rock star. I mean, I know in money, you know, I think I need a Learjet, but that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it, basically? And it also marks, you know, and Wish You Were Here and what else comes out, but it also marks, because they are different characters completely, you know, and especially the dynamic between Mason and Gilmore and, of course, Roger Waters.
Yeah, I mean... throughout their, even in their early career, they'd sort of reflect on what it was to be a musician. You know, some of their early tracks, like Cymbeline, you know, talk about the how annoying it is of having to do American tours. You know, so there was always that sense of, like, they were slightly meta. They would do songs about being a musician and touring. So that, but that really comes to fruition with Wish You Were Here, which everyone knows. You know, it's, they've got, that's famous for Shine On You Crazy Diamond, but it's also got songs like Welcome to the Machine, which is a really dark, macabre song, you know, really alienating, fantastic keyboards on it.
So we get to the end of the 70s and we're into, and we got another, The Wall. And as a teacher yourself, that must be an interesting listen.
It was probably, being an 80s kid, you know, growing up on TV, it was watching the film of that really, really brought the band to my attention. And I just find it a stunning piece of work, you know. Here is someone excavating all their deepest fears, all their deepest anxieties. I know that about their difficult relations with their parents, especially their mother, their school time, their school teaching, going through their sexual relations with women, and how difficult and how the traumatizing it all can be. And it's just an incredibly brave piece of work. I mean, it's not always easy listening, but my God, did he put himself out there.
Because Waters lost his father, didn't he, in Italy in the Second World War. I mean, he was killed at...
That's right.
Yeah, at Anzio.
That's right.
And an awful lot of that comes out, and you hear Spitfires, and you hear that sort of, all those war, you know, there are, you know, he's virulently, I mean, I'm not going to go into his politics because we could be here until Thursday, but do you know, but he is of that generation that is anti-war, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what they did always so well was they created the sound world, you know, so they used all that sound effects, you know, the Spitfire, the even trains passing, in the film as well, the details of it are so fantastic. The Argyle knitted sweater, the shorts that kids had to wear up till the age of 14 when they were going to school, the teacher with the sweater and the tie underneath it. You know, the detail on it is so fantastic. You know, it's so smart. Capture that.
Yeah, and another brick in the wall, the single itself, is a massive hit, again. But it's actually, you know, a single as opposed to, a six-minute piece, which we were kind of used to from 70s Floyd.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, Sid Barrett, I mean, for some reason, on the first album, he could do 3-4 minute pop songs, and it took the Floyd a long, long time to get towards that. You know, I think initially they were a bit too, I don't want to say snobbish, but they didn't want to sell themselves too cheaply in the marketplace, you know. But there comes a time when you realise that, you've got to give people what they want. And that means making things easier, more digestible, while keeping the interest of the song always alive. And, you know, the kids, the school kids singing still sounds amazing.
Indeed. By the early 80s, I think it's 82, isn't it, the Waters has had enough and he splits because, you know, he's off to plow his own furrow, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, the last few years working together seems to be in a great strain. You know, he took on the leadership of the band, you know, which is great. You know, his writing is just incredible for the last 3 or 4 albums. But by the time it gets to the final cut album that they do, you know, he had complete control. He's treating the rest of the band as basically just sidemen, you know. And, you know... it's not a great idea, you know. David Gilmour is one of the greatest guitar players of all time. And when you're cutting down his contributions, that's not very, very sensible. That's not a good idea.
But, you see, it would have been really easy for the band to go, okay, you know, Nick Mason's got his Ferraris. Gilmour can just live the life of rock stars. But they regroup, don't they? And they come back, and they come back. There's two things about Pink Floyd this time. Is A, they come back with momentary lapse of reason. And also, as a touring force... they become, I'm thinking, a very good friend of mine was the sound engineer on the Venice thing, and another one was a backing singer, a woman called Durga McBride, who was a backing, and so they come back as this powerhouse sort of live act, which you wouldn't have thought they would be able to communicate with an audience like that.
Yeah, it's interesting because... you know, after Dark Side, they don't really capitalize it in terms of touring. They actually tour less as it goes on, you know. But when it comes to Momentary Lapse, you know, we're talking 87, I think the economics of the music industry changed. You know, people were able to charge a lot more for touring. I think touring was also just easier to do as well. Also, Gilmour mentions that, you know, he just got divorced and he went a bit on the razzle during that tour. It was known as a party tour. So they were having great fun doing it. They went around the world and for 87 to 89, they did a hell of a lot of touring.
So when you come to write this, you want to set it in context, don't you? So how did you research the interviews you use and the reports? I mean, and the bootlegs. I mean, I applaud you for that one for a start, Mike. But how did you put it all together?
Well, I mean, so obviously first you're researching it. I mean, the albums are very well known to me, but you want to get all the written information that you can. You want to get all the interviews, you want to get Nick Mason's books and anything by any other people who were there, you know, you want to get all that familiar. And then you just want to start thinking, you know, what is this song trying to say? How is it trying to move you? What is the emotional effect that they're trying to create? And that's always what I was trying to put over. You know, I'm not a musician, I'm not a musicologist, but I'm trying to always describe the vibe. You know, what are they trying to create here in terms of feeling and emotion? So putting that all together, you know, with the British world cultural context, you know, that was the challenge of the book. That's what I was trying to do.
And how does your own appreciation of the band change? Because if you do that sort of deep dive, you're going to discover nuances that perhaps you didn't know the first time around. But if you focus in on this, you know, in its entirety, did you get a fresher? Because you probably think you know everything about Dark Side of the Moon or Wish You Were Here, but you probably found something new.
Right, yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone knows the song Time from Dark Side of the Moon, but I'm not sure that I've heard anyone say that the refrain, where it goes, every year is getting shorter, never seem to find the time, it's in poetic meter. It's in trochaic tetrameter.
What? Say that again.
It's in poetic meter. It's not iambic, it's trochaic.
Right. Okay. Was that on purpose, or do you think that was a happy accident, Mike?
No, that's got to be on purpose. Yeah. You can't just fall and stumble into that. Yeah. So it's the same rhythm as Hiawatha, for example.
Ah, fascinating. What are you hoping then people are going to find and discover from the book?
I mean, what I'm trying to do is like put it all into context. You know, what are the band trying to do? You know, so I think there's a very definite career arc to the band. You know, they sort of, after Syd Barrett, they really fumble around and they try and do lots of things, and some of it sticks and some of it doesn't, and they learn so much from each adventure or misadventure. Then they get to the, you know, what I call the hot streak, the great four albums, Dark Side, Wish You Were Here, Animals and The Wall, and those are utterly stellar albums that will stay with us forever. And then, you know, there's a bit of a slide afterwards, you know, there's the final albums after that. So there's a definite career arc. I'm hoping that people take away, you know, the what they're trying, you know, understand what they're trying to do, and, you know, be able to assess, you know, their achievement.
The book is called Everything Under the Sun, The Complete Guide to Pink Floyd. It's by Mike Cormack, who is speaking to you today. Mike, if people want to follow you online, do you have a website? Is there social media? Where can people find more about you and the Floyd?
I'm on Twitter, or X as it's now known. My handle is Bucket of Tongues, all one word.
Okay, that's an interesting one indeed. And do you ever find yourself sort of talking away to the end of the wall, you know, you laddie, what are you doing behind the bike shed, come here laddie, etc.?
Oh yeah, I mean, being a teacher, these things go through your head quite often, yes.
But the book is called Everything Under the Sun, The Complete Guide to Pink Floyd. It's by Mike Cormack, speaking to you today. You'll be able to order it from our own virtual bookstore. Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Reid and another brick in the wall, but you knew that already because you're clever people.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.